Welcome to the Book a Week podcast, jointly hosted by the SEPT University Library and the Center for Research on Architecture and Urbanism.
Hello everyone and welcome to Book a Week podcast. I am Soumini Raja, alumna of SEPT University, and with me today is Professor Lindsay Bremner. Today we will be discussing Professor Bremner's edited volume, Monsoon as Method, Assembling Monsoonal Multiplicities, published by ACTA. Professor Saloji of Azraeli School of Architecture and Urbanism, Carleton University, describes this book thus, quote open, "Monsoon as method is a rare and generous invitation to think with rather than merely about monsoon as an active agent in defining and pluralizing architecture's entanglement in complex systems," quote close. It is with great pleasure I wish to introduce our author for the evening. Professor Lindsay Bremner is a professor of architecture and director of research and knowledge exchange in School of Architecture and Cities at the University of Westminster. She set up the Architecture Plus Cities Climate Action Task Force in 2021 and 2022. She is also an award-winning architect and writer and have published, lectured, and exhibited widely. Her published works include Sedimentary Ways, Sedimentary Logics, and the Rohingya Refugee Camps in Bangladesh, Planning the Chennai Floods, Thinking Architecture from an Indian Ocean Archipelago, Fluid Ontologies in the Search for MH370, so on and so forth. So it's a pleasure to have you here as part of this podcast, Professor Bremner, and we really look forward to having a wonderful conversation with you.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
So just to start this conversation, can you share the inspiration behind choosing the monsoon as a central theme and the agential material for your book? What sparked your interest in exploring the monsoon in this unique manner?
You know, the project began when I was working on a previous project, which I called The Folded Ocean, which was looking at places around the Indian Ocean rim that were being impacted by globalization and climate change. So I brought those two fields of interest, globalization and climate change, to bear on a number of sites around the ocean. And in doing so, I became aware of the enormous kind of importance of the monsoon to the whole history of the Indian Ocean as a space. So that's really where it started, okay? And I decided that I wanted to delve a bit deeper into that phenomenon. And so that's what led to the Monsoon Assemblages Project.
There have been several other books that sort of focused on monsoon. And I remember as a child reading this beautiful book by Freighter, Chasing the Monsoons. And it has always been a dream to chase monsoon like the way he did. How does your approach differ? And what unique perspectives or methodologies does monsoonist method bring to the subject? If you could elaborate.
Okay, so I mean, we were very conscious when we started the project that we are a group of European researchers, and we certainly did not want to reenact a sort of colonial embodied aesthetic romance with the monsoon, as Freighter's book does, for instance. So the idea was to really look at the monsoon not as a thing, okay, but as a way of life and as a kind of as a particular way, and to research the particular ways in which cities had been made within the monsoon rather than seeing the monsoon as an object out there. And that led to kind of the two methods that we began to deploy to try and understand this entanglement at different scales and across history. And that was to use cartography or mapping and ethnography or very detailed observation and engagement in particular places. So our project really tried to bring together those two practices and find a way through the monsoon through ethnography and cartography.
As a reader, you know, what fascinated me a lot was the way the book is structured. It's very distinct. And these chapters sort of vary from deep city descriptions, like what you said, of ethnographic to sort of cartographic representations. And there are very personal accounts as well. So how did you arrive at this eclectic format, and what role do you see it playing in, you know, conveying the very idea of monsoon as not something that's outside, not something as an object, right, but something that you think with, that you live with? It's part of your life.
So we were, as I said, a small group of researchers, an anthropologist, a landscape architect, three architects, predominantly architects, and a political scientist, two of whom were PhD students. And, you know, when you're working with postdoctoral students and PhD students on a project like this, it's important that each person finds their way into the project. So it's not kind of conceptualized as a complete thing at the beginning. And so the various strands that the book takes were really the strands of research that different of our researchers took through engagement with each place. So for instance, as you read in my publications, I mean, I became particularly interested in sediment. The anthropologist became very interested in non-human kind of interlocutors with the monsoon. The landscape architect was very interested in atmosphere and the sort of wider terrain of the monsoon. So the book is eclectic because it kind of reflects the very provisional and incomplete research that we did on the monsoon and what became important to us as we engage with it in different places. And then, you know, in order to structure the book, we talked this through, and it became evident there was matter that was important there to some of us. There was non-human agency, there was infrastructure, and the monsoon was all of those things. You know, it wasn't just weather. And that's why the title is Monsoonal Multiplicities, okay, because it isn't embodied in one thing, but in a, you know, it's a multiple, essentially.
That's why I wanted to ask you, because monsoon is such a complex phenomenon that, and for me, who's living in Kerala, brought up in Kerala with monsoons, I'm wondering, you know, the narrative sort of takes readers through life or lives in Chennai, Dhaka. Could you elaborate on the criteria, or what were the considerations that led to the selection of, you know, these specific cities, which sort of situate itself in a region that is what we locally understand as, you know, the region of retreating monsoons, or Mumbai, or any of those cities, which sort of, you know, it is right at the forefront of monsoons as it enters the Indian subcontinent. I just understand why these three and not any other, or is that a project for the future?
And there were a number of factors that led to this. First of all, I knew that some really beautiful work had been done on the monsoon on the west coast of India. I mean, I'm thinking of Anu Mathur and Dilip De Kuna's work on Mumbai, work on Kerala, work on Goa, you know. And so I wanted to situate this project in the minor monsoon, you know, the retreating monsoon, and see, you know, and see where that took us. So that's really the reason. It was a conscious decision not to actually tackle the sort of west coast of Indian monsoon, given the powerful narratives that already existed about it. And then, you know, we arrived in Chennai and found that people don't even use the term monsoon. You know, they talk about the rainy season. They don't use the word monsoon. And, you know, we had to grapple with that for a while. originally we were going to do Chennai, Delhi, also a very non-monsoonal city, and Dhaka. And then after about a couple of years, we realized how important the Bay of Bengal was to this retreating monsoon. And so we decided to make it a Bay of Bengal project. And that's why we then went to Yangon. So that was the Toys of Cities was emergent in a way, you know. But you know, Somina, quite frankly, it was also where I knew people. You know, my school already had relationships with two of Chennai's institutions. I also had a personal relationship with someone in Dhaka. So, you know, it was also about those things. We didn't know anyone in Yangon. So we went there quite cold. And that was both difficult and interesting, actually.
I also wanted to bring in this idea of collaboration. And as you rightly mentioned about, there were architects, there were social scientists and landscape architects. And one thing I found very interesting was the discussion on design pedagogies and the engagement with cities and the academic design studios was very fascinating for me. So I really would like to know, how did these studios and the students who are involved in the studio contribute to the overall research? And because this is an architecture studio, it's a master studio you are. And what kind of insights did these students bring to the exploration of Mansoor's impact on design per se?
So the inclusion of the studios in the project was a little bit, it was quite experimental. And in fact, the European Research Council doesn't usually fund master's students. So I had to persuade them that this would be valuable. And the argument that I put to them was that we would be working with students to kind of test design methods, okay? And also to train, we were training a generation of architects to think about climate and the weather not as something out there, but as something that is deep, that they need to grapple with as more than just statistics. You know what I mean? And so we developed kind of some certain software programs. We started to develop the use of fluid dynamic software in order to model the monsoon. We started to use cartography. And we never gave the students a site, okay? We gave them a situation. So the design studios were all kind of formulated around situations that the students identified through field work, okay? So, I mean, I think the studios were enormously valued by the students. In fact, you know, they still say so. You know, there was a deep kind of engagement in a place that was very foreign to them, around this idea of kind of how do we actually work with the monsoon to identify a program, to find a site, to find, you know, to kind of find architectural form within this very, very complex weather system that's also social and political and material. They were successful studios, I think, but they highlighted for us as a research team the impossibility of really doing design, you know, for real people on real, you know what I mean? They were more theoretical than actually, they were theoretical design projects actually, because we didn't feel that we had the right actually to engage with people in places with such a short-term time frame and as foreigners. I would love to know what someone like you would do if you ran a design studio around the monsoon, someone who lives this on a daily basis, who lives with it. So that would be fascinating.
It would be very interesting because our associations with monsoon, what it was, what is the form of monsoon that we had in our mind, from the sandak chappal that you would wear as a child to the raincoat,
Yes.
the new umbrella that one would buy every June or May, and then for now to just look out and see there isn't a drop in the month of June or July, and then you are suddenly in the midst of a flood-like condition where the intensity of rain is so huge and your sloping roof may not hold anything, the intensity of water that comes in, and you might have to move away from where you have lived for a long time.
Kind of shifts that are happening are enormous, right? And the implications.
Especially in the last one decade or two, this shift, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm,
at least, mm-hmm, in the coast where I live. And mm-hmm, then to think of what does design mean?
Mm-hmm.
Just a roof? Is it just a chajja? Is it just a plinth, which you, you know, lift
exactly
down?
That you lift up and down. What does it do? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think the idea of shift itself, and what I really find fascinating in this book, is it acknowledges sort of a very deep entanglement between human and non-human factors. And there's a particular section on, as you mentioned earlier, interspecies interlocution, which I,
mm-hmm,
whether it be the hilsa or, you know, maybe a tree or something else, or maybe that one plant that one would look into. So what is that motivation that, you know, you had to explore this aspect of, you know, human non-human relationship, and what were the discoveries or reflections that emerged during this exploration?
You know, we really became aware of these species that sort of serve as, you know, that serve as signs of the monsoon approaching, the hilsa fish, whose whole lifestyle is driven by kind of monsoonal registers, and how the dredging of the rivers in Bangladesh are confusing the hilsa fish. So suddenly we discovered that by looking at snakes or fruit or dragonflies or birds, we could have looked at many other creatures as well. We learned new things about how the monsoon was changing. So they gave us access to certain kinds of knowledge that we wouldn't otherwise have had access to. That was really the exciting discovery. And actually, it was, as I said, the anthropologist who really pushed this. And for her, it began with the fact that wherever we went, we found the same species of dragonfly. She first noticed it in Chennai on the rooftop of the house that she was staying in. And then we found it again in Bangladesh, and we found it again in Yangon. I found it in Southern Africa when I went home for Christmas one year. So, you know, suddenly the flight path of this bird became very important to the project and tied regions together that wouldn't otherwise have been tied together for us.
This whole idea of, you know, looking at monsoons through non-human species sort of brings back this idea of what does boundaries mean after all?
Yes.
Where is a boundary for a dragonfly, where we are talking about cities situated in different countries? For them, that whole idea of monsoon sort of opens up the sociopolitical angle of what does it mean by such strict boundaries, which we...
Precisely, yeah. So what are the boundaries of the monsoon? You know, does it have any boundaries, or are they more gradients that seep into one another? Yes, it questions the whole nature of territory. And I think that's what climate change is doing as well. You know, the territorial boundaries, which we've assumed almost get extruded up into the atmosphere. That myth no longer exists.
Absolutely. And I think it's very important in this context of, you know, where there are wars that are being waged to increase boundaries and territories of humans. I think these blurring of boundaries are very, very important to sort of
Oh, very important. Yeah, we need to kind of rethink geography, actually. Yeah. By the way, on the non-human aspect of things, another book you could do for your podcasts is Man Barua's new book called Lively Cities, which is about macaques, monkeys, and parakeets and cattle in cities. It's the most beautiful urban theory book I've read for many years.
I mean, just to come back to the idea of Mansoor's method, as we are talking, there are, you know, different depths and, you know, multiplicities of perspectives that are covered in Mansoor's method. And also we know that this is not the whole of it. There are so many more stories that are there out there. So do you envision any kind of future project or the additional exploration? So do you have a plan for Mansoor assemblage?
The project I'm working on in Chennai at the moment, the British Academy project, called Reimagining the Good City from Enor Creek, that really is an outcome of the relationships that we built during monsoon assemblages, and also an attempt to really bring the projects down to the ground. Thinking through a project that works with another weather system that works mainly in the Northern Hemisphere as an attempt to kind of take the project further.
Right.
So I want to work with the jet stream, okay, which is a very upper atmospheric Northern Hemisphere weather system, which is impacting Europe, North America enormously at the moment. The storms we've had in the UK over the last 2 weeks, which have resulted in flooding that looks like Chennai in 2015, are a result of the kind of shifts that are occurring in the jet stream. So that's what I want to work on next.
Having published so much and then also very specifically on Indian Ocean and cities along Indian Ocean, how do you, hope readers will engage with and benefit from your book? And when I say readers, I'm, specifically speaking about an audience who might comprise of students of architecture, urban design, planning, architects, tutors and others.
It's of interest to people who try to move beyond thinking of architecture as form making, that architects make form and that's what we do, to rather think of architecture as energy and matter. So that sounds a bit abstract, but actually seeing architecture as a process of bringing together different energies, and those energies might be material, they might be the weather, but they're also energies of people, okay, and of relationships between people that one sets up through design. Obviously, we make form in the end, but how do you defer that to really research all the energies that are swirling around a particular project that you can tap into and reformulate? I think that's what the book is. That's how the book, I think, is useful for architects or designers.
Also, I as an architect and as an educator, what came to my mind when I went through this book is that architecture cannot be a discipline in a silo. It needs to and start speaking to, say, biologists, botanists, climate expert, and so on and so forth, because these forces that we feel shape the form of architecture.
I think you're absolutely right. Suddenly the disciplines that come into focus and need to be engaged with are very different from the disciplines that architectures engaged with in the past, and planners for that matter. Planners need to have hydrologists and meteorologists. Planning authorities need to have those people within their teams, I think, if cities are going to be more planned in different ways. So you're right, it opens up questions of who we talk to as architects, planners, and designers.
On a very personal note, was there a particular moment or realization during your research that significantly impacted you or reshaped your perspective on monsoons and its implications?
There were lots, but I think actually a moment that stood out for me was when we were standing on St. Thomas Mount in Chennai, which is one of the few kind of higher little hillocks in the city, and a storm was approaching. And suddenly we realized the importance of the sky in Chennai. I mean, there's just this huge sky, I guess, because the city is so flat. And so that was when we started using a particular way of photographing, which took our mobile phones and turned them on their sides, and we panned upwards from the earth to the sky. So instead of panning across a landscape, we panned upwards. And so we produced these really long photographs that talked about the monsoon as connecting the sky with the ground. So that was a particularly poetic moment, I think, that had a lot of value for the project.
Wow, that's a very beautiful experience, I'm sure.
It was, yeah.
So thank you so much, Professor Bremner, for finding time to, you know, sit with us and talk to us about this wonderful work. I thoroughly enjoyed every bit of what you wrote, you and your colleagues wrote, and I'm really eagerly waiting for a new assemblage in the making. So I really hope we'll get to read more on this, maybe from the same cities or more cities added to this. So thank you so much to you and your entire team.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure and an honor to talk to you. And I hope we come across each other again. Thank you so much.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. Do not miss to like, share, and subscribe to our podcast. Available on all your favorite podcast apps.